This week, in anticipation of the release of episode 200, I'm taking a break from the normal schedule to answer some of your most asked questions. Every week, I receive a ton of emails asking me all sorts of questions about the show, cases I've covered, some I haven't, other shows, and true crime in general. While it's impossible for me to answer every question I receive, I wanted to take this opportunity to try and tackle some of the most frequently asked questions and ones which I thought other people would like to hear the answers to. So, this is Trace Evidence, Episode 200 Special Q&A. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we're changing the schedule up a little bit to answer some of your most frequently asked questions. Before getting to those questions, just a few quick notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. One last quick note here. Next week, the week which begins on Sunday, July 24th, there won't be an episode release. I'm going to be taking that week off, but it's not really a vacation for me. I've done everything I need to put episode 200 together. The script is complete, all of my basic work is done, but I'm going to be making some adjustments to my settings and equipment, and I want to make sure the audio is exactly what I want it to be for 200 and beyond. So, no episode next week, but then episode 200 will drop on Thursday, August 4th. I'm really excited to get it out to you, and I think it's a case that's going to grab your attention and ask some difficult questions. Now, with that out of the way, let's turn our attention towards your questions in this special episode 200 Q&A. Beginning with Twitter, the Southern Lady asks, "Have you ever thought about doing an episode on the Freeway Phantom?" Yeah, that's a case that I've looked at several times, and I certainly consider doing an episode on it, and more than likely I will do an episode on it in the future. I think if anything, the only thing that's held me back is cases that have a higher number of victims. For instance, in this case, it's believed to be canonically 6 victims of the Freeway Phantom. It takes a lot more time for me to put it together because that's 6 people. I have to try and figure out their backgrounds and talk to people and find news articles and gather everything that I can. So there's actually quite a few cases I've been wanting to do which have a higher number of victims, serial cases that are unsolved. It's just a matter of the time allotment that I have and the ability that I have to be able to research all of that and put it together in a cohesive thing. I don't want to put out an episode that's 3 hours long and ultimately tells you a lot about the victims and their background, but case information's lacking or it's all too congested and there's too much information in there. So for me, it's just a matter of I have to figure out what the best approach for me is to do a case that involves multiple victims in that way. But Freeway Phantom is certainly on the list for the future, and more than likely in the next year or so, I'll probably release an episode on it. The Southern Lady also asks, why is the YouTube channel so far behind? That's a little bit more complicated of a question to answer. I ran into a couple of things this year that have slowed me down, whether it was issues with friends or family members health-wise, my own health, mental health stuff. I had jury duty I had to deal with, some issues around the house in terms of some construction they're doing that damaged power lines and things of that nature. So pretty much since the beginning of this year, I've just been hitting barricade after barricade. It's so strange because 2021 went off almost without a hitch. I released more episodes that year, I think, than any year I've done the show. And then 2022 hit and it's just been disaster after disaster. Thankfully, it's looking like that's starting to clear up, but I don't want to speak too soon. So the show itself became the primary focus for me. I wanted to keep getting episodes out. So that's what I did. YouTube takes a lot of time for me. So I started training my girlfriend to work on the YouTube videos, and I've been working on the YouTube videos. But there's a lot involved there. Gathering all the images together, putting the timeline of the video together, inserting the effects, inserting the title cards, making sure that it makes sense and I didn't miss anything. So basically, it just became a matter of let me, with everything in my life being chaotic, let me focus on the show, get as much of that going as best as I can. And then in terms of YouTube, I've just gone back and been trying to catch up on it. This week, I've got episodes 192, up to 192, I think, that are uploaded. 191 and 192 aren't out yet, but they're in my YouTube. I just have to schedule them. And 193 and 194 are going to be into my YouTube within the next couple of days. So my goal is when episode 200 drops in the first week of August, I would like the YouTube channel to probably be, if not all the way up to episode 199, in the 197 or 198 range. So I am working to try and catch it back up. It's just really, really time consuming. And I did not think that the YouTube side of this podcast would be what was vastly more time consuming, but it is. So I apologize about the fact that the YouTube is behind, but I am working to catch it up. Next up, Andrew asks, do you plan on doing trace evidence for years to come? Well, in the simplest way I can answer this question, the answer is yes. I mean, I would love to do trace evidence for the rest of my life. Do like 10,000 episodes of it, have a really long running podcast that hopefully makes somewhat of a difference and draws attention to the lesser known cases that a lot of the bigger true crime shows and TV shows and all that really don't focus on. They try and go for what's more sensationalized, what's attention grabbing, what's more gory, what's more twisted. And my view on it is it's more about what cases can you actually help versus you're just covering, but it's not going to help anything. So as long as I can continue to put out episodes that are up to my standard, that people listen to, and that I believe can possibly make a difference, I'll continue to do trace evidence for as long as I possibly can. Now, that doesn't mean there might not be some changes over those years. I always told myself that if the numbers started declining and less people were listening and the show was clearly on the downslope, I'd probably alter the show and make it more of a bi-weekly release rather than every week, because every week is really hard to keep up with. But especially if the numbers were going down, then I might as well take the time to focus a little bit more on the cases I'm working on and be able to give like a bigger spotlight to them rather than different case every week with still nobody really listening. So in the end, how long trace evidence runs kind of comes down to you. As long as people continue to listen, then it's something that's viable for me to keep doing. But if it gets to a point where no one's listening anymore, then I'm not sure what the point of continuing to produce the episodes would be. So as long as people continue to like trace evidence, listen to it, and find it interesting, then the show will continue. Once people decide it's not their thing anymore, then that'll probably be the end of trace evidence, like anything else. Next up, Sharon asks, do you only do stories of missing Americans? I would love an episode on Corey McKee. His disappearance is still bugging me. No, I don't just do missing Americans. I mean, I do missing people and murders, but I do them from around the world. The reason you don't see me do a ton of cases from outside of the United States is generally due to a language barrier or my inability to get information. My access to local newspapers outside of the U.S. is somewhat limited. My ability to communicate with people who don't speak English or I don't speak their language is obviously limited. And my ability to have knowledge of certain cases outside of the United States is somewhat limited. It's not like the media over here reports a ton about things going on in other places in the world when it comes to disappearances and murders. So I am more than open to doing cases from other places. However, if you're going to suggest a case that you'd like me to do from somewhere else, and maybe it's a case that it might not be easy for me to find any information on, anything you can give me along with that suggestion would help. So say you want to suggest that I do a case out of Japan, and all the local newspapers there covered it, and there's a lot of information, but it's not something that I generally have access to. If you have access to it and can send me, you know, screenshots of it or a link to the newspaper articles with a like on a Google translating page or something like that, that helps a lot. There's a lot of cases around the world I've looked at and been fascinated by and wanted to cover and just kind of ran into that wall of I can't find enough information to do this, and I can't find anyone who will give me that information. Plus, in the United States, with the Freedom of Information Act, I can at least request from police departments and sheriff departments and the federal government information about these cases. And in a lot of instances, they say no, but in some cases, they give you some information. in a lot of countries, I can't do that, or I'm not sure what the options are for that, which is on me. I have to do more research into that. So to round out your question and to quit rambling, I would say if you want me to do cases from around the world, I have no problem doing that. But in your suggestions, if you can supply me with a summary and any kind of links or pertinent information that could help me, that would make it so much easier. The next question comes from Kat Callie, who asks, how long does one episode take from start to finish? It varies from episode to episode. Obviously, some episodes I have more information available than other ones. And other episodes, I think I don't have very much information. And then I start digging and I just have a ton of information to sort through. Generally, on average, an episode takes 40 to 50 hours. I've never sat down and really timed it out. I just know how long I spend in the office on average and how many days a week that I do that. And it's very easy for me to be at my desk doing research, writing scripts and other things. And it's 8 to 10 hours a day for 4 to 5 days of that week. So it all depends on what information is available to me, how involved the case actually is, what's known, how many people are factored in. Are any other cases in any way tied into it? Is it serial related? Is it completely out of the blue? Are there family members who are questionable? There's so much more involved in putting an episode together because I try to present it to you in a way where it's, here's everything we know. I don't really want to present it to you in a way of, here's what probably happened, because I don't know. And I think it's disrespectful for the victims for me to turn around and be like, clearly this is what happened. So even when I do the theories, I sort of give you a pros and cons and I tell you what I think is likely and not likely, but I'm not going to come out here and just tell you, here's what happened. So at the end of the day, I think it's very time consuming, and 40 to 50 hours is about average. I've obviously had some episodes where it was 25 hours, and I've had episodes where it was far, far beyond 40 to 50 hours. So 40 to 50 hours is about the mid ground. That's probably the average. So I hope that answered your question. Next up, Jay asked, what are some of your favorite movies? Also, do you enjoy comedy? To answer your second question first, I love comedy. I love a lot of stand-up comedy. I love comedy movies. I'm always watching goofy videos on YouTube or like streamers who are funny. To me, especially to balance out my workload, which is almost always overwhelmingly emotional and dark and hard to deal with, I like to have a lot of comedy in my life. And it helps out that I sort of grew up in an environment with that's how my family dealt with dark situations and complicated things was through comedy. Death in the family, going broke, whatever the case was, we found a way to pull humor out of it. And so my sense of humor developed out of that. And I think a sense of humor can get you through a lot of things in life. So yeah, I love comedy. If you're asking specifically about like stand-up comedy, I'm a big fan of George Carlin. To me, he's always my number one stand-up comedian, but I love a lot of other people too. So I don't want to get into a big thing listing off names, but that's just a general example. As for your first question, what are some of my favorite movies? That's really hard for me to answer. Movies have always been a thing in my world. I grew up watching a lot of movies as a kid. My father was really into movies. So as an adult, I have a ton of movies on DVD, Blu-ray, 4K. I even have some VHSs still laying around of stuff that's not available on any other formats. So I'm a huge movie fan. In terms of favorites, I couldn't possibly give you a list that's accurate because it changes from week to week based on where I am mentally, what I'm feeling, what's going on in my life. But off the top of my head, I would say Halloween, Tombstone, Escape from New York, The Fog, Captain America Civil War, Captain America the Winter Soldier. I'm big into the Marvel movies, although some are vastly superior to others. In terms of more classic stuff, I really love Bogart. So I love Casablanca, In a Lonely Place. I like some of Hitchcock's old work, but not the vast majority of it. So yeah, I have a lot of favorite movies. It always changes, but every single day I watch a movie when I'm done with my day. I sit down on the couch to relax and it's a new movie, whether it's one I've seen a million times or one I haven't yet seen. So yeah, movies are a big part of my life and so is comedy. From Twitter, Acknowledge Him asks, do you think Carrie Stainer turned out like he did because of Steven's abduction, or do you think he was just evil to begin with? That's a really hard question to answer from a lot of different perspectives. I guess it depends how you view it. There's always this debate in psychology of the whole nature versus nurture. Are evil people born or are they created? Well, the general consensus tends to be that it's a blending of the two. So the easy answer here would be that he was born possibly with some dark tendencies, and then things that occurred throughout his life, like Stephen's abduction, may have pushed him further one way or the other. Whether or not he ever would have done what he did had the abduction not occurred is a question we're never going to know the answer to. But I think in most of these cases, people are the combination of the way they're born, the environment they're born into, and the things that they experience. I'm sure there are examples of cases where people are born and just start doing terrible things as soon as they start out, and it just never stops. And I'm sure there are cases of people who are totally fine, and then something happens in their life and they turn sideways and everything goes bad. But I think in most cases, it's not a black and white answer. There's a lot of gray there. And I don't have the ability to answer this particular question because I'm not well informed enough about it. But I would say it's probably a combination. And at the end of the day, the abduction probably didn't help with whatever was going on in his head from the time he was born. Greg asks, have you seen Who Took Johnny? If so, what are your thoughts? I haven't. I have some familiarity with the Johnny Gosch case because it crossed over into research I did on other cases. I don't know. I certainly wouldn't call myself an expert in the Johnny Gosch case. I know the basics. I think the one thing I would say with Johnny Gosch is I tend to be more of the pessimist, where I think Johnny was probably abducted and murdered rather quickly. I don't believe it was him who showed up at the house years later, allegedly, and talked to his mother, whatever the story was that she gave there. I don't think that happened. I think that's a woman who's been through a hell of a lot of trauma, and maybe someone showed up at her house to screw with her because there's terrible people out there. Or maybe somebody was trying to find a way to make some money off of it. I don't know, but I don't believe that was actually her son that showed up there. And if I had a gun to my head, I would probably lean towards the likelihood that Johnny Gosch died when he was young. He's not still out there somewhere, as sad as that is. So again, I haven't seen the documentary. I'll take a look. Because I'm curious and I think it's an interesting and sad case, but I'm not one of the people who tends to cling to a belief that he's still out there somewhere. There's something more going on, or he's being kept from coming back, or I think he's gone, unfortunately. And I hope that at some point they're able to figure out what happened there and who was responsible. And maybe his family can find some comfort in knowing the truth. Our final question from Twitter comes from Mark, who asks, how has the landscape of podcasting changed since you first got involved? Has it been more positive or negative? That's a really interesting question and a really complicated one, too. I think whether or not it's positive or negative is based on your personal experience. I'm sure for some people, the changes have been really positive. For other people, they've been really negative. I think it's been a blending of the two for me. I've seen a lot of positive come out of it, but I've seen a lot of negative, too. But in terms of how it's changed, you have to understand, when I first got involved in true crime podcasting, it was May of 2017. So it was over 5 years ago now. There were probably 100 true crime podcasts at the time, and now I would guess they're somewhere in the thousands. It was also, most true crime podcasts you were listening at the time were indie podcasts. It was people like me sitting in their home office or their garage or whatever, wrapping a pillow around a microphone to isolate the audio and protect it. And that's how it was. Now you've got all these corporations involved in it. They've got studio quality products that they're able to shoot out from episode one. Anyone who's listened to Trace Evidence from episode one, you hear the audio change. You hear my presentation change. You hear the way the scripts are done change, because it's an evolution. But when you're working with a company or somebody that has access to those really expensive recording booths, knows how to produce something properly, you've got engineers who know exactly what they're doing with the audio, and then people whose entire jobs it is to narrate things or do voiceovers, it's really hard to compete with that. For me, it hasn't been all that negative, because a lot of those corporations do what I mentioned in an answer to a question previously. They focus on the big cases that are the big stories with the brightest spotlight, with the biggest twists and the darkest subject and the most horrifying details. Doesn't really impact me, because I'm able to look at cases that nobody's looking at for one reason or another. So that's sort of one, depending on where you stand, it could be positive or negative for you. But it's not just corporations. Everything's changed. A lot of the new podcasts that pop up, I don't know. I don't want to sound like a jerk when I say it, but I generally know within one episode if I'm going to continue to listen to a podcast or not. It's pretty clear, especially what I tend to do is a new podcast shows up and I go and I listen to an episode on a case they've done that I know really well. And if they hit all the beats and they had the information right, I'll probably give them a shot. But if they're messing things up or they're repeating information that we know now is inaccurate, I'm done. I'm not going to listen to them anymore. And my experience with a lot of new podcasters have been that they come in with a lot of steam. They're excited. They want to get involved. They want to do something. And 6 months later, they're not doing the show anymore because they're not rich. The amount of people I've spoken to who think you just create a podcast, shoot episodes out, people listen, and you rake in money. I don't know where they got that idea from. It certainly hasn't been my experience doing this. And I'm sure there are podcasts out there, we've seen them, who come out, they cover something, they explode, they're huge, they get TV deals and all, so they make a ton of money. That is not going to be the average person. And it's very limited. It's like anything else in life. How many people do you know that have acted in a movie? Well, how many people do you know that run a podcast that make over, you know, $1 million a year or something? I know a ton of podcasters, and I don't know very many that make close to that number. So I think the landscape of podcasting is changing that a lot more people are involved in it now, but I also think it's changed in that the focus primarily now for a lot of upstarts is money. Can the show make money? Does the show make money? Not, hey, I'm really invested in this and I want to help. Not, I'd like to put the focus on a case that no one's paying attention to. Just, can I make money? So I think overall, like everything else, the podcasting landscape has changed based around advertisers and companies and corporations and all this stuff. I think across the board, it's probably been more positive than negative, but there's certainly been some negatives out there. So, interesting question. I'd love to expand on it more, but I don't want to bore everybody else to death on it. I'd really be curious what you all think of how the podcasting landscape has changed, because I see it from my perspective as a host. You're the ones out there listening. Are there new shows that are grabbing your attention? What are you listening to now versus what maybe you listened to when you first started? How have your tastes changed? What do you look for? I think that's an aspect of the podcasting landscape that doesn't get taken into account enough is the listeners. It doesn't matter what case you're covering, what product you're putting out. It matters who is listening to it. And if you're doing a really good job and nobody's listening, then that's not going to be great for anybody. How is it going to ever build up? You have to find a way to break through. At the same time, there's podcasts out there that I would argue do a terrible job covering cases, and millions of people listen for reasons I can't understand. So I think it's all based on a lot of different factors. The landscape has certainly changed, and it's going to keep changing. My greatest fear with true crime podcasting right now is how viable is it going to be in the next couple of years? Because I was able to leave my job and make this my prime focus. This is 100% my job. This is my career. This is what I do. But if the landscape changes a lot and it shifts and all of a sudden nobody's listening, that puts me in a position where I don't have a career anymore. And I either got to figure out changes I can do to the show to catch up, or I have to move on to something else. And I think a lot of people are sort of confronting that. I also think there's the question of how long can you legitimately do it? How long can you do true crime before it just weighs on you so much, or you need to get away and do something else? Because I'm someone who I consider myself mentally very strong and resilient, and it wears me down really badly. So I guess the landscape of podcasting has changed a lot and will continue to change. And I'm really curious to see what it's going to look like in the next 10 years. Moving on to questions submitted via Facebook, our first question comes from Kateri, who asks, when you first started Trace Evidence, did you ever imagine you would get to this 200 episode milestone? Also, if you weren't a true crime podcaster, what do you want to do for a career? In terms of the career question, I always wanted to be a writer, which is still pretty much what I consider myself to be. I know I'm a true crime podcast host, but the writing aspect of it is the part that I spend the most time and focus on. So in a way, I am doing what I wanted to do, just not in the same way. Of course, I dreamed as a young person of writing novels and getting published and being famous and having a bunch of books out there. The older I got, the less that mattered to me. And it was more about, I just wanted to write and connect with people. And I didn't care if I wrote a book and five people read it, as long as those five people felt really impacted by it, like it spoke to them and it touched them. And that's the way I view writing now. So Whether or not I ever try and put out a novel or anything like that, I don't know. I've had offers to do true crime books where I would take one case or a handful of cases and write them out and put it all together in a book. But I don't know. I don't know that that really interests me enough. I'd rather just do podcasts on the cases than put a book out. So, yeah, for a career, always wanted to be a writer. I guess that's kind of what I am. As for your first question, no, I never imagined Trace Evidence would reach this milestone. I never imagined Trace Evidence would reach episode 20, let alone 200. When I first started the show, I figured I'll record it, I'll put it out there, and people will listen or they won't, and we'll see what happens. And I got lucky enough that people listened. But it very easily could have gone the other way, and nobody could have been listening. And then who knows what I would be doing now. So I didn't never imagine that I would hit this milestone. I kind of still don't accept that I've hit this milestone yet. So I guess we'll see what happens. Maybe when I hit like episode 500 or 1,000, it'll finally sink in for me. But for now, I'm still kind of in awe of the whole process. The next question comes from Mike, who asks, do you have something special planned for episode 200? A big case or maybe something unexpected? For me, it's a big case. I think for a lot of people listening, it'll be unexpected and it'll probably be a case you've never heard of. I hadn't heard about this case until about 2 years ago when I stumbled across it in the weirdest way. And ever since then, I've been really fascinated by it and really drawn into it. I don't want to give too much away about what episode 200 is going to be about, but I'll say this much. Episode 200 is going to ask some complicated questions, and they're not going to be who did this, because we know who did it. They're going to be questions of why was it done, and is the story that's been told ever since this crime was committed the real story of how things happened, or the cover story to protect someone who was responsible for a death? So that's about as much as I'm going to give you on 200, but I do think it's really fascinating. It asks some interesting questions. Mental health plays a role in it. Especially the view of mental health back then versus today, which, sure, we look back in time and think people had a really skewed vision of mental health and didn't understand it. But I'm pretty sure in the future, they're going to look back at our current time and say the same thing. So while things have improved, I don't think they've improved that much. And I think this is a case that really focuses in on mental health, but also focuses in on class structure and the idea that for some people, a life carries less value if the family that life came from doesn't have as much money as the family that the killer came from. Another way I could kind of put this is if you go back and you look at episode 100, which was the investigation into the death of Kurt Cobain, I didn't focus on was Kurt Cobain murdered or did Kurt Cobain take his own life or was something else going on here? Was there a conspiracy? My question that entire episode was simply, did the Seattle Police Department adequately investigate? That's sort of what I'm doing with this case for 200. It's not going to be a question of who did this? Can we solve this mystery? It's going to be, was this handled properly? Did the police investigate properly? And how much did societal station play a role in finding someone innocent or guilty of a crime? Next question comes from Jocelyn, who asks, are there any episodes you look back on and wish you had done differently, whether that's in how you presented it or the audio, technical stuff, etc.? Oh, yeah, a ton of episodes. I think almost every episode I've ever released, I look back on and think I could have done that better. The ones that really bother me are probably, if I'm being honest, episodes 1 through about 49 or 50. For a broad amount of reasons, there's the audio quality issues. I hadn't figured out exactly how I was writing a script yet. I don't feel I presented cases in the way that I would present them today. I think those episodes would be done differently. And every year I have this debate with myself of should I go back, rewrite, re-record, and re-release episodes 1 through 50 or 1 through 20 or 1 through 30. It's always changing. I've asked before and listeners have told me they didn't want me to do that because they like hearing the evolution of the show. And I understand that. But I've thought about doing it and then making the original episodes available elsewhere, or maybe releasing the episodes as like a 1A and a 1B. Like, this is episode 2, and it's the first time that I did it, and now here's 2B, which is me 5 years later redoing it. Something like that. I'm unsure. Maybe you guys give me your thoughts on that. I'd be curious what you think. Should I redo older episodes and put more information in and tackle them the way I would now, or should I kind of leave things as they are? Next, Jacob asks, With episode 100, you changed the presentation of the show, getting rid of the background music, adding in more sound effects. Do you have any changes planned to begin with episode 200? I do, actually. I already previously mentioned I'm going to be changing some settings around and reworking some of my audio equipment. I'm undecided on the background music aspect of the show. Some people continue to email me to this day and tell me they miss how there was background music in episodes 1 through 99. Other people tell me that they hate the background music, so it depends. I've thought of maybe trying to do something where there would be background music incorporated into the show, but it wouldn't be constant. Maybe as I'm discussing something that reaches a peak, you'd hear like some music coming up and we'd cover something really important and then the music would slowly fade out as we move on to the next thing. I'm sort of undecided on that. I always wanted the background music to be there because an inspiration, a huge inspiration for me to do this show was Unsolved Mysteries. And I thought their use of music was really well done. They knew when to use the sad music for something that was supposed to emotionally stir you. They knew when to use sort of more creepy music when they were getting into the more obscure aspects of the case. So I'd like to figure out how I want to do that. And I haven't mastered it yet, but I have a lot of plans. And next week when I'm off, I'm going to be playing with a lot of that stuff. So whether or not there's background music or music that comes in or out or sound effects or whatever, it's all something that I'm going to decide next week, because I'm going to record the script audio and then I'm going to play with all of those things for several days straight and get it to a place where I feel like, all right, this is what I want it to be. In terms of the structure of the show itself, I've always had it evidence section and then theories section. Sometimes I consider eliminating the theories section because there are certainly cases where I feel like there's not much of a theory to discuss here. We know almost nothing. This person disappeared. It could have been anything. And I don't like when I do the theory section and I basically have to say, like, well, it could have been anything. This guy could have done it. That lady could have done it. So I've debated that back and forth, but for now that remains in and it'll remain in for 200. And we'll see where that goes in the future. But as always, I'd love to know your guys' thoughts on this. And if you go to the website at trace-evidence.com, there's a link for a listener survey to ask a lot of questions about things that I'm looking at adjusting moving into episode 200. So if you haven't filled that out yet and you want your opinions included in the calculations, then go to trace-evidence.com, click on the 2022 listener survey and answer some of those questions, and we'll see if the changes I make are positive or negative. Either way, I'll pay attention to what everybody says, and if 200 comes out and people like it but they're complaining about this or that, I'll make adjustments on the fly. But at the end of the day, I also have to produce the show that I want to produce. I learned pretty early on doing this that if I listen to everyone else and make all the changes that people want, it quickly becomes a show that isn't my show anymore. It's someone else's. And I don't really want to work for someone else. I want to do my own thing. So as far as I'm concerned, as long as the evidence is there and it's clear and I'm giving you everything I know, that is the core of the show, and everything else is kind of adjustable depending on circumstance. We'll get right back to answering all of your questions after a quick word from this week's sponsors. If your doctor can recite every line from the movie Thor Ragnarok, but can't remember your name, it's time to get a new doctor with ZocDoc. ZocDoc makes it easy to find quality doctors in your network and in your neighborhood. Plus, with real verified patient reviews, you can find the right doctor for you, one that actually remembers your name. I have a real phone phobia for reasons I can't explain. Having to make calls and schedule appointments, especially with a new doctor, is a task that's almost overwhelming for me. With ZocDoc, though, I don't have to worry about any of that. With the mobile app, I can find a doctor and book an appointment without having to struggle dialing the phone. I use ZocDoc, and you should too. ZocDoc is a free app that shows you doctors who are patient-reviewed, take your insurance, and are available when you need them. On ZocDoc, you can find every specialist under the sun. Whether you're trying to straighten those teeth, fix an achy back, get that mole checked out, or anything else, ZocDoc has you covered. ZocDoc's mobile app is as easy as ordering a ride to a restaurant or getting delivery to your house. Search, find, and book doctors with a few taps. Find and review local doctors. Read verified patient reviews from real people who made real appointments. Now, when you walk into that doctor's office, you're all set to see someone in your network who gets you. Go to ZocDoc.com, find the doctor that's right for you, and book an appointment in person or remotely that works for your schedule. Go to ZocDoc.com/trace and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then start your search for a top-rated doctor today. Many are available within 24 hours. That's zocdoc.com/trace. Zocdoc.com/trace. If you're anything like me, you often find yourself so busy during the week that making a healthy, nutritious dinner just doesn't fit into your schedule. Well, now that problem can be easily solved, thanks to Gobble. Gobble delivers gourmet, freshly prepped 15-minute meal kits right to your doorstep. Their chef-designed meals are easy to prepare, with simple recipes and fresh ingredients that have been chopped, portioned, and simmered so that dinner is both fast and flavorful. Gobble combines the convenience of takeout with the health, satisfaction, and freshness of a home-cooked meal. New seasonal menus are released weekly and include dishes for every palate. Whether you're looking for global cuisine, protein personalization, low-calorie options, comfort classics, vegetarian recipes, or kid-friendly meals, Gobble's got you covered. Each week, members can select from a new selection of 12 to 15 entrees, as well as their rotating menu of sides, soups, salads, breakfasts, premium kits, and desserts. Gobble meals start at just $11.99 per serving. Members can choose between two-person or four-person plans, as well as select between the classic or lean and clean plans, depending on your meal preference. Now, Gobble has a special offer for Trace Evidence listeners. Visit gobble.com/trace to get your first six Gobble meals for just $36. That's six meals for only $36 when you visit gobble.com/trace. Start your road towards easier, healthier dinners today at gobble.com/trace. And now we move back to your questions. Next up, George M. asks, in previous Q&As, you've mentioned your struggles with depression. I hope this isn't too personal, but how is that going? Has it improved at all? I really appreciate when you talk about it because there's still so much of a stigma out there for people suffering from depression or other mental health issues. It varies, honestly. My depression is really strange, or at least it's strange to me. I'm sure there's plenty of other people out there who have experienced it like I do. I can wake up in the morning and I feel fine and it's a good day and I go about my life, or I can wake up in the morning and just getting out of bed is almost impossible for me. It's hard to ward off dark thoughts or to focus and get things done. I've been going to therapy for around 7 years, I think, now, and it's been really helpful. It certainly changed my life in a lot of ways, but there's still things I struggle with. In just my past therapy session, I was talking to my therapist and I was saying, you know, I'm starting to feel like there's no way out of this. Like, I have one of those depressions where I have to learn to live with it, and that's it. I've tried, I think, 8 to 10 different medications in the past calendar year, and none of them helped. And in fact, some of them made things worse. I've been doing therapy for years, and that helps in some ways, but in others, there's really nothing that can be done there. So I'm still struggling with depression. It's a daily thing, and I've kind of come to terms with the fact that it's probably never going away. And the best that I can do is try and figure out how to live my life to work with it. The problem just is how powerful it is. It can take anything good or great in my life and it can find the dark side to it. And then I start focusing on that and dropping into it. And you look into all these different ways to try and positively affect your depression, to change it or get control of it. The problem I have, and I'm sure there are others of you out there like me, is it seems like everything I need to do that everyone advises me would dramatically help with my depression are things that I find almost impossible to do because of my depression. And I have this debate back and forth in my head all the time as to whether or not that's my depression talking or me talking or laziness or whatever it is. And you just get lost in this dark cycle, giving all these different reasons why the problem might be purely yourself. I am trying to do certain things to improve it, but I've lived with it. I've known I had some form of depression probably since I was around 12 years old. So I've been dealing with this now for almost 28 years. Sometimes it's all right. Sometimes it's manageable. Sometimes I can't get out of bed. So I appreciate you asking the question. I wish I had like a more positive answer to give you. But in all reality, it's just a matter of I'm trying to take everything day by day now. And some of those days, I feel like I'm dragging an anchor behind me. And other days, it's perfectly normal. So hopefully it'll improve. And I'd love a platform or an ability to speak a little more broadly and openly about depression and mental health. I've thought about doing a show where I interview other people who suffer from depression or mental health issues and we discuss them. But I haven't really worked any of that stuff out, and I don't know whether I'll do it or not. But if it's something you'd be interested in me talking more about, or if it's something that you'd want to learn more about, or something you're struggling with, let me know, because I often have thought about just doing a one-off like video that I would release on YouTube, where it would be like, hey, this isn't about trace evidence. This is all about my mental health and depression. Let's just talk about that. So I'd love to know your guys' thoughts on me doing something like that. Next up, Sandra asks, how has your process of doing the show changed over the years, if at all? It's changed a lot. I used to do it in this really weird way. I used to pull all of my research. I would spend a whole day gathering all the news articles, interviews, everything that I needed for an episode. And then instead of reading through all of them, I would put them in chronological order, and then I would start working on my script and bouncing back and forth between my sources and my script. And I sort of wrote it almost in like a real time where, oh, I just was reading this and that's going in here at this point. And I somehow thought it made more sense to try and do it that way. Over the years, what I figured out is it doesn't work to do it that way very well. You can do episodes that way and it'll be fine, but if you really want to go deeper, you have to do it a little differently. So what I've been doing the last probably 2.5 to 3 years is I pull all of the research first. I put all of my notes together first. And the process of just taking notes from like newspapers and sources like that can take me 10 to 12 hours just to get all my notes done. Then I have to organize them in a way where it flows with how I plan to tell about the case. Generally, I like to go in order, so I try and put things in chronological order after I've already taken the notes. But you'll find a lot of stuff where maybe in a news article from 1987, they gave you very basic information, and then in a news article from 2015 where they reviewed the case, they give you a hell of a lot more information. So you have to do a lot of jumping back and forth. But in terms of note-taking and everything, that's completely changed for me, as have my sources. I have a lot more places that I go to try and find information now. In terms of the actual recording, that's changed too. I used to record evidence, theories, intro, ads, all of that stuff in one sitting and just do it in order and that's it. Now, a lot of times what I'll do is I'll write the intro, I'll record it, I'll see how it feels. That might change my intro to the evidence section and what I've written there. I might alter that around a little bit based on what the general show intro was. And then I'll move through the evidence and record all of that before I've written a word of the theories. Because I find a lot of times I'll be recording an episode and I have my notebook and I have notes written for what about this and what about that and all the stuff I'm going to put in the theories. But I find a lot of times as I'm recording it, I'll read something from my script and be like, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. Then I'll start looking into that and then that gets added to my theories list as what about this weird thing. So the process has changed, just not dramatically. I think now it's more about how can I put everything together in a more concise way that still expresses all of the information that needs to be known, and how can I present the theories in a way where they're asking deeper questions rather than like, gee, was this person abducted or did they run away? So the show has changed, just not dramatically. And I'm curious if anyone out there has noticed any difference between, say, episodes 110 and 199. The final Facebook question comes from Jimmy, who asks, I know this may sound like a real broad question, but I thought I'd ask anyhow. What is it like being a podcaster? How has your life changed since you started? Is it what you thought it would be, or were you surprised with how different it all is? Honestly, my life hasn't changed that much. I know that when I meet people at events and stuff, they come up to me, oh my God, you host Trace Evidence and all that. But for me, my general everyday life, I live in a small town. I don't think anybody here knows what a podcast is. I think they're still all listening to like AM radio. It's also like a retirement town. A lot of the area that I live in is populated with older folks who a lot of them don't listen to podcasts. Some do, obviously. But I've met a ton of people here who ask me what I do and I say I'm a podcaster and they ask what that is. I'm sure that's a problem a lot of podcasters run into. So I don't think my life has changed all that much. I haven't had anybody come running up to me on the street or anything and recognize me. I don't feel like I have any level of fame or anything. I mostly just feel like I'm still doing the same thing I was doing 5 years ago before I started the show. I think the primary and major difference between now and then is that this is my full-time job, whereas when I first started, I had a different full-time job that I was working and writing the episodes in my free time. So as a podcaster, not much has changed for me. For people in my life, it's a little different. My parents sometimes run into people and they'll see a trace evidence sticker on the car and they'll be like, oh, I like that show. And then of course, you know, my mom or somebody is happy to say, oh, that's my son. My brother started listening to my podcast about a year ago. He likes to message me about it now, which is kind of funny. So little things here and there, but nothing big. And when I hear my show, it doesn't really affect me in a way where I feel like, oh yeah, that's my show. I don't really like to listen to my show. I don't like to hear my own voice. So I avoid a lot of that stuff as well. But ultimately, I think my life has changed much more for the positive than it could have changed for the negative if things had gone differently. So yeah, my life is different, but I'm not really all that different. I still feel like I'm pretty much the same person. Turning to emails, our first one comes in from Harold, who writes, I really enjoy your podcast. I appreciate all the research and work you put into producing it. I especially like the end of each episode where you go over various theories as to what happened. In any case, my question is, do you do this full time? And if not, what is your day job? Right now, I do trace evidence full time. I've been doing trace evidence full time since 2019, mid 2019, somewhere around there when I left my last job. Basically, prior to doing trace evidence, I had had goals of writing, which I didn't think were attainable. So I wanted some kind of a safety net. My safety net on that was a split decision between psychology or teaching. And I never really figured out which one I would prefer to do. So I took a ton of psychology in college. I took a ton of history in college because I thought of teaching history. And when I was all done, I still didn't really know what I wanted to do. Now, I only have an associate's degree. I couldn't afford to go on to a college to finish off my bachelor's, which is what I sometimes think about doing now, but I don't know how the hell I would ever have the time to take on a full course load and do this podcast. So right now it's just something I'm not going to be able to obtain. But had I gone on and finished 4 years, I probably would be teaching history somewhere right now. Psychology, as fascinating as it is to me, the only avenue that I thought was viable was going to be being a therapist. And I don't know that that would have been enough to keep my attention or to make me really interested in the work that I was doing. And in terms of teaching history, there's always this issue of, are you teaching history or are you teaching textbook history? And the two are very different. What actually happened versus what we say happened. Anyone who's ever read a couple of different books about a particular historical event, I think, knows how obvious it is that we have an idea of what happened in a lot of history, but we don't know exactly what happened. And, you know, the people who won tended to write the books and they put the spin on it that they wanted to put on it. So I don't know that that was something that was going to work out for me either. The last jobs that I worked before I started trace evidence were in retail logistics, which basically meant that I was responsible for setting up deliveries, making sure we were getting what we needed, scheduling the trucks to come, being there to make sure everything was unloaded as it was supposed to be and everything was sorted properly. It really wasn't a glamorous job. It wasn't that much fun. And it was my experience that a lot of retail stores didn't know what the hell they were doing and had a bunch of rules in place that didn't make any sense. So that wasn't really going to work out for me either. I had worked at one place for several years. They went out of business. I transferred to another place where I knew some people that worked there. But after about a year of working there, the podcast really took off. And I thought, why would I keep putting myself through these headaches of having the same arguments every day when I can just walk away? So that's ultimately what I ended up doing. I guess my greatest fear is that when the podcast comes crashing down, that's what I'll have to walk back to, which I'm really not all that excited about. Next, Cheryl asks, have you ever thought about doing a different podcast? Not getting rid of trace evidence, but maybe a side project or something with a more lenient schedule. Yeah, I think about that all the time. I've thought about doing different podcasts. I've thought about just doing a YouTube channel on different things. It's all a matter of time, though. Trace evidence takes up the vast majority of my free time. You can pretty much ask anyone in my life and they'll acknowledge the same thing because I have friends that want to hang out and it's like, I got to finish this episode or I got to finish this research or I got to talk to this person or I'm expecting a call from this police department. I've missed a lot of events that I didn't want to miss. I love Halloween. It's my favorite day of the year. I don't think I've left my house on a Halloween in the past 3 years because I'm busy working. That being said, I do have some ideas in mind for side projects. One revolves around history. One revolves around narration, which I know that's really not that helpful of an answer, but I don't want to be too specific about it. I would love to do something like that. It just wouldn't be able to be at the same rate as trace evidence. So the way I always looked at it was if I wanted to do a side project, what I would have to do is write the whole thing, record the whole thing, have all the episodes ready to go and scheduled to go out. That way, it's never going to interfere with my weekly trace evidence work. If I keep going at the rate that I'm going, I'll never have time to do anything else. So I have to find some time to squeeze something in because, yeah, I would like to do something on the side, something maybe that I could focus on that doesn't have such an emotional impact. Next, Marla writes in reference to episode 199, "You pronounced everything relating to Hawaii street names and such in perfect manner. I listen to all different crime podcasts while working for the state on Maui. I used to live in Oahu, and I came across this podcast to add. Mahalo." Well, thanks, Marla. I really appreciate that. I know there's not much of a question in there, but it's nice to know that I pronounce some things right, because I get a ton of emails from people yelling at me or trying to correct my pronunciation of different things. Now, when it's a city name or a person's name or something, I do everything I can to try and find out exactly how it's pronounced, but you'd be surprised to learn, I think. Just because you pronounce something one way doesn't mean everybody pronounces it that way. I mean, I've covered places before where I got emails saying I said the city wrong while I was getting emails from other people saying that they were surprised I got the city name right. I always try to get pronunciations accurate. It's never going to be completely perfect. And anyone who's listened to me talk for any particular period of time knows I have my own specific pronunciation. I don't say forward, I say forward. That's the way that I grew up. That's the way that I speak. It's just an aspect of me. So I just wanted to include this one and thank Marla for letting me know that once in a while I get something right. Next up, Kevin asks, "I love when you do these Q&A episodes. Is there a reason you don't do them more often?" Yes. The reason I don't do Q&A episodes more often is because a lot less people listen to them. I never really understood it when I'm listening to a podcast and they release a Q&A episode. I'm always curious to see what people are going to ask. I'm curious to know more about the hosts. But generally speaking, and it's not just me, I've talked to other podcasters about this. When you release a Q&A episode, you can essentially expect that your downloads are going to be at least 25% lower. People who aren't subscribed to the show but download week to week based on what the case is tend to see a Q&A and they just bypass it. That's the way it is. I understand that. I don't mind. But the reason that I don't do them more often is because just not enough people actually listen to them or engage with them. So if you'd like me to do more Q&A episodes, I would love to do that, but I would have to have more of a response to them. And generally speaking, that doesn't happen a ton. People kind of just move on by. So right now, I think this year I've done 2 Q&A episodes, maybe 3. There's probably going to be one more in 2022, and that's going to be it. I think once a quarter or so is about right. Next, Janine writes, "Your schedule lately has been a little erratic. Just wondering if you're all right and healthy." Yeah, the schedule has been kind of all over the place, but as I mentioned in a previous answer, I've just run into a ton of issues this year that were unexpected, whether it was health-related, family-related, friend-related, work-related, jury duty, whatever it was, traveling across the country. I just ran into a lot of issues, and I'm thinking, hopefully, that they're predominantly behind me at this point in time, but overall, I would say that I'm healthy. It's not anything where I'm struggling with something that's ultimately going to overtake me, at least not that I'm aware of. So the schedule should get more locked in tight moving forward into August. 200 set to come out on the 4th, and then you'll get episodes on Thursdays following that. So hoping to correct the schedule, and I apologize for the scheduling issues, but it has been unavoidable this year, and I cannot wait for 2022 to be done. Next, our question comes from Thomas, who writes, "I've been thinking about starting my own podcast, not true crime, and I was just wondering what equipment you use for your show, what you record with, what software you edit on, etc." That's pretty simple for me to answer. So right now I have an Electro Voice microphone, RE20, I think, hooked up to a DBX286S processor. Then that processor goes into a Scarlett Focusrite interface. That interface connects to my iMac, and I record in Logic Pro, which is the paid version of GarageBand. It has a lot more features. So equipment-wise, that's about it. A microphone, a processor, which you don't even need a processor, depending on which microphone you get, and an interface so that you can connect your microphone to your computer. There's obviously a lot of different factors involved, whether you want a USB mic or an XLR mic, or if you want one of these giant microphones like I have, or you want a smaller one, or you want one that's more for bass in a voice or more for the peak of your voice. That's one thing that I didn't know before getting involved in this, was all these microphones are really different and accent different features of your voices. For the first 4 years of trace evidence I recorded with a Shure SM7B microphone. For the last year, I've used the Electro Voice. I may switch back to the SM7B with 200. I may not. It depends how my audio testing goes. At the end of the day, though, my advice to you if you're looking to start a podcast is don't go out there and buy all top dollar stuff. Build as you go. Get a decent microphone. You can get a decent microphone for $200 or less, depending on what you get. Get a decent mixer. These Scarlett interfaces are great. You can get one for like $100. And if you've got a laptop or a desktop computer that you can put software on to record with, you can use free things like GarageBand or Audacity. Work on your show, build it up. And if the show is successful and it's something you're going to continue doing, then start investing in your equipment. But I'm not a proponent of spending $1,000 on a bunch of equipment before you start a show that might not go anywhere. And I think a lot of people do that. I think a lot of people get caught up in gathering all of the equipment. Like somehow, if your show isn't of the greatest quality, but you make the audio fantastic, it's going to be better. To me, it's all about the core of what the show is. And yeah, I need you to have a microphone where you don't sound like garbage when I'm trying to listen to you. But I don't need it to be super professional. I don't need it to sound like it was produced by, you know, Fox Studios or something. I just need you to be able to communicate in a clear way. I need your information to be interesting, and I need the episode to draw my attention. You could have the most expensive microphone in the world and the most boring podcast at the same time. So make sure you know what you're getting into. Make sure you're doing what you want to do and build as you go. Don't just dive right in expecting that it's going to be a success from day one, because you're just going to lose some money if you do it that way. Next up, Henry asks, do you still listen to other true crime podcasts? And if so, what are some of your favorites? Admittedly, I listen to far less than I used to before I started doing mine, but I think it's because how much true crime can you really expose yourself to without going a little crazy? You know, you work on an episode all day and then you relax by listening to stories of other cases. It doesn't work out well for me, although I do still listen to true crime when I'm driving, when I'm showering, if I'm cleaning the house or mowing the lawn. I love to have a podcast on. That being said, if I'm going to listen to true crime, it's going to fall into a pretty small group of podcasts, and I'm probably going to leave some out because I can't keep track of everybody. But right off the top of my head, the podcast that I listen to the most often, Once Upon a Crime, The Trail Went Cold, Criminology, Gone Cold, Texas True Crime, Defense Diaries, and The Zodiac Speaking. Those are my recommendations. Those are what I love listening to the most. If you haven't checked those out, or you've checked out some but not the others, give them all a shot. They're all worth listening to, and they're all done a little differently. I think it's important to note that I'm a matter-of-fact kind of guy. I like the facts. I like to know what's going on. I don't like a lot of chatter. I don't like a lot of speculation. I like to know, here's everything we know about what happened. What do you think happened? So those are the shows that I tend to listen to. Next up, Lindsay asks, have you ever started an episode and decided not to finish it? What's the furthest along you've dropped a case, and what made you change your mind? I've dropped several cases that I was working on at the time. I actually dropped a case recently about 3 weeks ago. I had all the research done and I had the script half written and I dropped out. In that instance, the reason I dropped out was something didn't feel right. And I can't really explain that to you. It's something in my head. But there was something about the script as I was reading through it and going over it where I just felt like something's missing here and I need to find what's missing before I can complete this script. And I'm still working on finding it for that case. In other cases, it depends. Sometimes I'm in the middle of writing something and it gets solved. Sometimes I'm in the middle of writing something and I come across a question that I can't find an answer to, but I should be able to find the answer to. Other times, it's a matter of I write a whole episode out and then I look and I'm like, okay, three other podcasts did this. Let's see what they did. And I listen to their coverage and I'm like, oh, I really have nothing to add to this. So me doing an episode on this isn't going to add something new. It's not going to draw new attention. It's just going to be rehashing. And I don't really want to do that. If a case has been covered by four or five podcasts and they've done it really well, I don't think you need me to throw my two cents in there as well. So generally speaking, it doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen. Probably once every 15 or so episodes, I start working on one and drop it. There's a handful that I've started working on and dropped several times. I really want to do them. There's just not enough information available out there. So to answer your question, yes, I do drop episodes sometimes, and the furthest along it's ever been was when the script was actually completed. Next up, Annie asks, what stops you from covering a case? Is it always about how much information is available, or are there other factors you consider? I consider a lot of factors, but the information is the most important. If I can't adequately tell you the story, there's really no point in me trying to cover the case. So most of the time, the reason I don't cover a case is because of a lack of information. There are other reasons. In some cases, it's because other people have covered it enough and you really don't need me to throw my two cents in there. Sometimes it's because of developments around the case. The police come out and say something they haven't said in a while. It's like, all right, let's see if this is going somewhere, if they're laying down a trail, if they actually know much more than they're saying right now, and maybe some revelation is going to come about. So I don't want to do a case and I release it and a week later it's solved and it's like, okay, why did I even do that? But yeah, I think it's mostly information. Other times it's the community, which is sort of a vague answer, but there are certain cases out there that people are really, really, really vehement in their beliefs and they don't care what facts you provide them with one way or the other. If it disagrees with the way they see it, they will go out of their way to try and attack you and make it as much of a mess as they can. I don't really want to steer into any of those places, so I tend to avoid them. Also, if a case is like super, super, super well known and has been covered not only by podcasts, but they've made, you know, docudramas on TV and Netflix has a special, I'm probably not going to cover those either unless it's a case that I feel really connected to or I have information that they didn't share and I felt like it's important that that information gets out there. Our next email comes from Scott, who asks, do you tell us everything you know about a case in an episode, or do you keep some information to yourself? That's a really interesting question. I think the short answer is no, I don't tell you everything that I know about a case in every episode. In most episodes, I try and tell you absolutely everything I possibly can. However, I have covered some cases where the police worked with me or the family did, or I was able to get files and there was information in there that isn't necessarily pertinent to what happened, but is interesting. So I have to decide, is it worth me sharing this information, even though it might not have any impact on the case? Other times there's information where I've been told by people involved in the case, we don't really want anybody to know this, or we haven't shared that. In those situations, I'm obviously not going to share anything that someone's told me off the record or that could negatively impact a case. I have no desire to be the host of a podcast that becomes famous because I break information about cases that other people haven't broken at the risk of damaging the investigation and the possible prosecution of a person responsible for it. I tell you everything that applies to the case and everything that's need to know. And yes, sometimes I leave out information that wouldn't affect the case one way or the other, but might negatively impact somebody involved with the case, or could possibly give someone a clue that police are looking at them or consider them a possibility. I don't ever want to interfere with an investigation. So I tend to just kind of go with, here's what's publicly known. Here's what I'll share with you. In some instances, I'm able to find information that isn't publicly known, that isn't damaging, and I'll share that with you. But every once in a while, I come across something and there's no need to share that. A good example is when I did the Robert Hamrick episode. I have the police investigation files from that, and there was a ton of information in there. But there was a lot of information in there that was kind of, I don't know, it seemed like the person writing the report was throwing shade at the family a little bit for asking questions. So I wasn't going to include everything that they wrote about the family, a lot of which was negative, because what role does that really play in the investigation into this case? Stuff like that. Obviously, I've done some episodes where I've said they've never publicly named the suspect, but if you look hard enough, you can find his name. I'm not going to name somebody that the police themselves haven't publicly named or that the family hasn't publicly named, but you do sometimes come across that where you're like, all right, this alleged person of interest that they're talking about is clearly this person, or somebody will even acknowledge that in communication with me. Oh yeah, it's this guy. Well, I'm not going to share that and then potentially ruin that person's life or bring them undue stress or harm because they are maybe considered a person of interest in a crime, but there's not enough evidence to do anything about it. I think that's a lot of what true crime podcasting is it's a balancing act. You can't always give everything that you would like to give, not at the cost of a case. I will give you everything I possibly can, but if I think me saying this or me sharing this information might make it harder on the police or the families, or it might give the suspect a way out, I am not going to share it. Next up, Jennifer asks, I got to meet you at CrimeCom, which was so much fun. You were really nice and chatted with me for a while, indulging my endless questions. This was my second CrimeCon, and it was really exciting, but I was wondering what CrimeCon or any public events like that are like for you as a podcaster. Generally speaking, CrimeCon is, for me, a lot of fun, but a lot of work. This past year, it was in Las Vegas, and the way the schedule was set up was basically I was at my table from 8 or 9 in the morning until like 6 p.m. or something like that. They were long days this year. But, you know, you had to find a way to squeeze in a lunch break there. You want to be at your table as much as you possibly can. That's the whole point of being there. So I am at my table about 95% of the time. I think the only times I left my table this year was if I wanted to grab a quick smoke break or I was hungry and I needed to get something to eat. Luckily, the way they had it arranged, there were food places all within very short walking distance of where the podcast row was arranged. Overall, it's been a very positive experience for me. I've met a ton of other podcasters who I've gotten to know and collaborate with and share ideas with. I get to meet reporters who cover these cases who oftentimes offer me up information or say, if you ever have a question about a case in my state or this city, drop me a line. And I've had a lot of success working with people like that. I think overall, the thing as a podcaster with CrimeCon or any of the other events that are held is, you can easily look at them like, oh, I'm going to this fun place, going to meet all these cool people, and it's going to be great. And in a lot of ways, it is that. But it's also work. It's part of your job to go out there, get more people listening, get the cases out to more people, get new cases suggested to you, speak directly with people who are involved in them, learn what's going on out there. I think if you take it that way, it's a really enjoyable, fulfilling experience. And the one thing I'll say about CrimeCon that has remained true every year that I've gone, every time I come home from CrimeCon, all I want to do is make my show better. Our final question comes from Kendra, who asks, where do you see trace evidence going in the future? I'm not really sure where I see it going exactly. I have an idea in mind of how I would like the show to evolve. But I think in the end, what I would like trace evidence to be is consistent. I'd like for you from episode one through wherever the show ultimately ends to feel like you were always listening to the same show. One of my issues with podcasts, TV shows, movies, whatever, is when you've seen something or you've listened to something and you love it and it's awesome, and then out of nowhere, they just dramatically change everything. They change the way they present it to you. They change the music. Maybe they replace the person reading, or they present information in a different way. I don't like that. I get used to the way something is. I like the way it is, and then they change it, and I stop listening or watching. So I never want to make an adjustment to trace evidence that's so extreme that people are like, this doesn't feel like the same show anymore. I've always wanted it to be evidence followed by theories. That's basically the core of what the show is. That's the way that I plan for it to remain. Changes in the future are probably going to be simply things like what kind of music is used, where is it placed, what kind of sound effects, where are they placed, how do I factor in changes in the medium in general. There's going to be an evolution. True crime's going to continue to evolve in podcast form. Do I change with the changes? Do I keep my show the way that it is? But ultimately, in the end, where do I see it going? I see trace evidence going as long as I can possibly do it, covering as many cases as I can possibly cover, and hopefully maintaining a reputation for being highly detailed, highly accurate, and highly respectful of the victims. That's my goal for the future, and that's where I hope it's going. I'm always amazed at how thorough and unique your questions are. I love doing these Q&As for all of you, and you always ask such interesting questions. Believe it or not, I only answered 25 questions here. There's hundreds more that I'd like to get to in the future. If you asked a question and I didn't answer it, don't be discouraged. I kept all of them, and I'll find ways to answer more in the future where I don't have to release Q&A episodes more than 3 or 4 times a year as it currently is. So thank you all for all of the support you've shown me over these previous 199 episodes. Thanks to all of you who asked questions, whether I got to them or not. And thanks to everyone who continues to support Trace Evidence, and I hope will continue to support Trace Evidence moving into the future. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Donna Buttram, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Eloanne Meyer, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Haley Christie, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Jill Sense, Joni Berkowitz, Julie Mangano, Kara Moreland, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Marla Wright, Melissa Brakeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stacy Finnegan, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Adorable Susie Summers, Taylor, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. This completes our special episode 200 Q&A, and thank you all again for your questions, for listening, and for being supportive of the show. Next week, there won't be an episode, and then on Thursday, August 4th, episode 200 will be coming to you. So, thank you again so much for your support, for your questions, and for listening, and I hope you'll join me on August 4th for episode 200 of Trace Evidence.